this is Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, some small communities are starting to plan festivals once again. They're important for bringing in people and dollars to those towns. Schools in Illinois might soon need to incorporate Asian American history into their curriculum. We'll hear from those supporting that idea. In southern Illinois, Canada geese were a fixture in the fall and winter. That brought hunters to the area and also boosted the economy. But the geese aren't showing up in numbers as before, and we'll learn some answers why. The effort to place a large casino in Chicago worries some in neighboring Gary, Indiana, where a new gambling spot just opened up. And we'll find out about the newly created Space Force and hear from some cadets training here in Illinois. That and more coming up on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll try to get some answers on why Canada geese show up in southern Illinois in much smaller numbers compared to just a few decades ago. A program in one school district aims to get young people of color interested in becoming teachers. And we'll learn more about the role Illinois is playing in the Space Force. That and more coming up on Statewide. Last year, the COVID-19 pandemic forced many small towns to cancel large festivals they depend on for tourism. Some communities now are holding those festivals again. Katie Pikus with Harvest Public Media reports what this means for small towns in the Midwest.
People wearing traditional Dutch clothing are throwing buckets of water onto the street. It's part of the Orange City Tulip Festival, celebrating the small Northwest Iowa town's Dutch heritage.
That's right. Give them a round of applause. Oh.
Locals scrub the street to pave the way for this year's elected Tulip Queen and her court.
Feels refreshing to be back doing something that we love.
Brandy Pals watches the parade with two of her friends. They're all locals who volunteer at the three-day celebration. This is the Tulip Festival's 80th year. The town had planned to mark that milestone last year, but it got canceled that spring. And that was a blow to the town. Orange City's population is 6,100, but the festival draws in at least 80,000 people from around the world. Mike Hoffman with the local Chamber of Commerce says it's a big gain for the town, but it's hard to say how big.
You can't put a finger on the fact that people come back and experience the small businesses throughout the course of the year, not just during the festival.
A little while after the parade, people sit in the Dutch bakery enjoying pastries.
And then one Dutch letter.
Small businesses like this make a lot of their yearly income from the festival. The bakery's owner, Lauren Mulder, says the money his business makes over these 3 days equals about 2 to 3 months of normal income.
It probably makes or breaks our year. Without it, it would be more difficult for us to survive, basically.
Mulder says last year was tough. After the pandemic forced restaurants and other retail to close, he had to lay off some employees. Dutch Bakery did curbside pickup to stay afloat. While pastries are definitely a draw, most people come for the tulips. More than 30,000 bulbs are planted around Orange City in the fall. By festival time, the bright colored flowers are in full bloom. Carrie Drescher points out a couple of her favorites in her yard, a pink tulip with some yellow and an orange tulip.
The Blushing Beauty and the El Nino, they're just a big, giant tulip. They always bloom beautifully.
Carrie co-owns Tulip Town Bulb Company with her husband, Dan. They import bulbs from the Netherlands and plant about 3,000 for the festival. People visit the Dreschers to pre-order bulbs for their own yards and gardens. They say tulips are pretty easy to care for.
People that can't garden, you can grow tulips.
You can plant them completely incorrectly and upside down, and
they'll
turn themselves over and push themselves through, and yeah, they're pretty resilient.
Stain Muckow and his family admire the tulips. They moved from Portugal to the U.S. last year and drove an RV 6 hours from Minnesota to Orange City.
We wanted to get out, and she wanted to come and see this down here, and now that we have the RV, we're camping every weekend and going out.
Orange City isn't the only town that holds a big Dutch festival. About 4 hours away in central Iowa, Pella's Tulip Time is a huge economic booster. Valerie Van Coten is with Pella Historical Society and Museums.
Tulip Time brings in $2 to $3 million to a 30-mile radius of Pella, to the restaurants and the hotels.
Van Coten says Tulip Time saw around 160,000 people this year, fewer than a normal year, but more than expected. She says last year's canceled festival had a silver lining.
A lot of people realized, oh wow, if Tulip Time were to go away, it would really hurt this community.
And that's something a lot of towns have realized. Their businesses, and sometimes much of their economy, depend on these big festivals. Katie Pikus, Harvest Public Media.
Before Macomb High School seniors received their diplomas this spring, they received a gift connected to a renowned civil rights leader who grew up in that community. Rich Egger tells us more.
First, the students participated in a graduation ceremony rehearsal under overcast skies at the football field. Normally, they would be dismissed after running through the rehearsal, but this time they were asked to stick around. That's when all 140 of them learned they would each receive a copy of the Reverend C.T. Vivian's recently published memoir, It's in the Action, Memories of a Nonviolent Warrior. And furthermore, two of Dr. Vivian's daughters and one of his granddaughters were there to personally sign and hand the books to the students.
What's your name, huh? Alex. Alex, A-L-E-X, like that. I don't have to worry about misspelling that one.
The women engaged in conversation with each one of the students. Denise Morse is Dr. Vivian's second daughter. She flew up from Atlanta, Georgia for the day and says it was well worth it.
Daddy loved Macomb. He loved Macomb High. And so it just seemed like the perfect thing to do, considering that the book has just come out.
She says her favorite parts of the book are about Vivian's childhood.
Just the stories he told about growing up in Macomb and being a student here and the people he met and the life lessons it taught him.
Morse hopes readers will appreciate her father's lifelong commitment to justice. She called the book a great little send-off gift for the students. Byron Odin Shabazz came up with the idea for the gift.
What can we do to get the book out but honor him at the same time, and donating a book to each student that we thought was the perfect project?
Odin Shabazz is president of the recently formed C.T. Vivian Project, which is a foundation created to continue Vivian's legacy. He says one of the group's goals is to give a gift in honor of Vivian to each year's graduating class. C.T. Vivian grew up in Macomb and graduated from Macomb High School. He went on to serve as one of the leaders of the American Civil Rights Movement of the 1950s and 60s. He died in Atlanta last July, just a couple weeks shy of his 96th birthday. Rich Egger reporting.
Asians have played a part in American history for centuries, but their contributions are rarely taught in schools. Over the past year, hate crimes against Asian Americans have spiked. Some think education could be a way to combat the problem. A proposal in the state legislature calls for Asian American history to be added to the school curriculum, and Susie Ahn from WBEZ has that report.
The first Asians that arrived in North America were Filipinos in 1587. Students are surprised when they learn that in Albert Chan's Asian American Studies class,
which predates the Puritans, which predates the Pilgrims, there was a group of Filipinos on Spanish galleon ships that arrived on the west coast of California. But that's not in our history books.
The history teacher in North Suburban Niles is one of a handful of educators across the country who teach a class in Asian American history. A proposal in the Illinois legislature called the TEACH Act aims to make it a requirement to teach a unit of it in elementary and high schools. Chan teaches at the same school he attended as a teenager, but he never learned any Asian American history there. He says growing up Chinese American, he'd hear racist taunts in class and on the playground.
I didn't really know what to do with that information. I didn't really know who to talk to about it. And even when I went home, my parents would say, oh, just, you know, keep your head down, you know, work hard at school, which is typical of many Asian Americans and how we're raised.
He says not seeing himself represented in the class only made him feel more invisible. He says the lack of education allows hundreds of years of stereotypes and racist characterizations to dominate people's perceptions.
That miseducation, well, what it does is it teaches us that our culture has no value, that our people have no value as Americans.
Over the past year, there's been a rise in anti-Asian hate fueled by rhetoric that Chinese people are responsible for the coronavirus. Song Ah Cho is an organizer with Asian Americans Advancing Justice Chicago, a group that helped draft the bill.
Unfortunate thing is the rising anti-Asian racism, which we have been living with for some time, has intensified, which is, you know, what we expected, which is why we've been doing bystander intervention trainings. But because of this, there's like really a moment where people are seeing this is really important.
Cho says schools could create a unit on their own, but there are also free teaching materials and resources the state has already identified. The bill passed the Illinois House, but not without opposition. During a floor debate, Representative Avery Bourne of downstate Litchfield said she was moved by the testimony, but voted against the bill.
This should happen at the local level where school boards and parents and students, like the students who testified in our committee, can have this heartfelt conversation within their community of how do we become better.
Representative Fred Crespo of suburban Streamwood questioned the proposal at first, saying what's to stop more groups from pushing to have their histories taught in schools. He changed his stance after talking to his wife, who is from the Philippines.
And she starts telling me things that's happened to her the last 10, 15, 20 years. I consider my wife my best friend. She knows me better than most people. But she started telling me things I've never heard about. It broke my heart.
Chicago High School senior Alyssa Santos listened in on that debate.
He knew nothing about what she experienced as a Filipino growing up in the United States. And that conversation at home happened because of the Teach Act.
Alyssa thinks about schools with few or no Asian students. She doubts Asian American history would be a voluntary topic of conversation. And that's why a statewide curriculum is necessary. A painful moment sticks with Alyssa this year. Days after the Atlanta spa shootings in which several Asian women were killed, one of Alyssa's teachers gave students time to talk about what they were feeling.
Instead of the discussion on how we can support the students in our class who are visibly upset, who are sharing their thoughts and the fears that a lot of them have had, then it shifted to a whole thing about the definition of a hate crime. And it was very traumatizing.
Alyssa thinks if there'd been education and a deeper understanding of Asian Americans, there wouldn't be these discussions that feel dehumanizing. She's hopeful for the bill's passage. She says it's American history that all students can be excited to learn. Susie Ahn, WBEZ News.
Each week, Statewide brings you reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. We're glad you're along with us. And a reminder, you can find our weekly podcast through the NPR One app. Many people switch careers during their lifetime, leaving the old for the new. But one Northern Illinois creative has found ways to intertwine many of her passions. Yvonne Booz brings us her story. Go
ahead. Mem Eichmann has evolved in her artistic direction over the years. She grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, where she studied ballet as a child. She says Eugene Collins and his wife taught at her school, and their inspiration made her decide to focus on dance as a profession.
But I just felt I really think I would like to pursue this because it brings in the music and your body moving to music and, air and space and time.
She originally wanted to go to Juilliard, but says her parents thought she was too young. For her, Butler University seemed like the next best option. She succeeded in her dance career and used her knowledge to teach others. Eichmann was the artistic director at the Midwest Ballet Theater in the Chicago area and the director of Midwest Ballet Academy. Then came a point where she realized it was time for her to move in a different direction.
Working with high school girls, girls almost exclusively, I did have a few male students, you get to this point where you're like, okay, I just would like to do something else. And that's when I got back into the folk scene.
She sang as a child and wanted to go back to music, so in 2005, she picked up playing hammered dulcimer. She says she soon realized how natural this was for her.
Because you really have to memorize everything, and you really memorize it in patterns, which, as a dancer, things work in patterns rather than memorizing notes, necessarily, or lyrics. As everyone knows, I'm terrible at memorizing lyrics. So.
That same year, she joined other musicians to form the band Trillium. Movement and music weren't the only artistic forms Eichmann possessed. She went to Butler University for dance, but ended up attaching herself to something else.
I had an extraordinary American authors professor that I had for 105 English, and then, you know, this was back in the dark ages practically. But he's the one that really got me interested in women writers.
Eichmann already wrote poetry and song lyrics, but this exposure to female writers from around the 1900s piqued her interest, and she began doing research.
I started gathering journals, letters, and short stories, again, from women that were the frontiersmen women from like 1880 to about 1905, 1910. And I got really interested in what these women would write. Most of them glossed over all the hardships that they experienced.
After delving into this genre, another evolution took place for Eichmann. In 2017, she finished writing her first book, A Sparrow Alone, set in the 1890s. She then wrote a sequel, Muskrat Ramble. Eichmann explains that all of her creative endeavors are parallel to each other. She says these things make it sound like she is indecisive, but her original goal was to be a dancer.
And that automatically had to be first, no matter what else I wanted to do. You know, the other passions, shall we say, were worked as a sidelight and, you know, never, you know, abandoned, certainly. But, you know, that focus had to be in place.
Eichmann is no longer dancing, but she continues to juggle working with the band, writing children's music, and creative writing. Eichmann says she was able to balance all these facets of the arts because they are interests that she carried with her from childhood. She wants young people to realize that life changes and it's hard to decide a definite path. So, she says, they should plan for the future, but shouldn't be afraid to transform their strategy as needed. I was dancing with my Yvonne Booz.
Just ahead on Statewide, across the Indiana border, the town of Gary worries about the impact a future Chicago casino could have there. Stay with us for more of Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Getting young people of color interested in becoming teachers. We'll have that story for you. And a reminder, you can find all of our episodes there at statewideshow.com. We have the links to the stories that you hear each week. Well, up next, despite the pandemic, casinos across the country are still seeing a lot of traffic. They raked in more than $1 billion in just the first 3 months of this year, matching their best quarter ever. That interest in placing bets is at full peak in the Chicago area as well. The newest casino to enter the competitive market opened right across the state line in Gary, Indiana. But some are also concerned about how a future Chicago casino could impact Gary's bid to turn its fortunes around. Michael Puente tells us more.
The glitz of Hollywood, the shine of Las Vegas, the larger-than-life guitar outside the gleaming new $325 million Hard Rock Casino, Northwest Indiana's first and only land-based casino.
The location is phenomenal, but the brand and the property itself, I think, are going to separate itself from the rest of the market.
That's Matt Schuford, president of the 200,000-square-foot Hard Rock Casino, Northern Indiana.
This is an incredible opportunity for the city of Gary. For them to have what is being built and the team and the brand and the facility that's going to be in the city of Gary, these are exciting times.
From Wish TV, Indianapolis.
Gary's had exciting times before, like 30 years ago, when Indiana lawmakers first began the process of allowing gambling in the state.
And the city of Gary, Indiana is rolling the dice again this evening.
Tim Shella is at the State House now with the latest in this historic debate.
The casino measure is being sold as a Gary rescue bill, and promoters are saying that it will create more benefit than a lottery or paramutual betting.
Gary was the first city in Indiana to get casinos, with two gambling ships on Lake Michigan's southern shore. It brought millions to a city starving for new investment, and jobs and revenues were generated in big ways, says Scott King, who came into office as Gary's mayor the same year the boats arrived.
When the boats came in, it was job creator.
the funds, the city's share of revenues generated, be for capital expenditures, you know, equipment purchases, construction, demolition.
The city purchased new police cars, fire equipment, fixed some streets, and made needed infrastructure repairs. But then moves by state lawmakers, including giving huge tax breaks to U.S. Steel and changes to how property taxes were collected, Gary was forced to use its windfall on basic necessities.
As time marched on, this capital funding source really, really, really got diminished because of actions by the state legislature. The bloom faded somewhat in a fairly short period of time.
The Gary Rescue Plan never materialized in ways state lawmakers and Gary officials hoped. But the casinos have lived up to the hype, generating nearly $400 million for Gary over the last 25 years. King, who left office in 2006, says he still sees casinos as a good thing for the city, even if revenues are spent on items that aren't visible to the public. He fears, however, that money may not always be there.
Is it a good thing to have? Yes, it is. This isn't going to be a magical fix for everything. You know, I remain concerned for all of Northwest Indiana on the casino revenue side with the development of casinos in Chicago.
And that's the elephant in the room. If and when Chicago gets a casino, how it impacts Northwest Indiana's cash cow industry by luring away customers. Plus, with the advent of online sports betting, it's making brick-and-mortar casinos everywhere work harder, says Ed Feigenbaum, who's been covering the gambling industry in the Midwest for decades for Indiana Gaming Insight.
You know, now that you've got gaming literally on every corner and on everybody's, you know, living room couch because of mobile sports wagering, you know, you've really got to offer a special product to get people to come out and play.
Feigenbaum says Hard Rock is entering a very competitive, mature, but uncertain marketplace with long-established operations in three nearby cities and in Southwest Michigan. But he says Hard Rock isn't going to shy away from that.
Hard Rock is going to put in a very strong, competitive product. And they're investing a great deal of money. They're sparing no expense. They've got a great brand and a great reputation. It's really going to be a different kind of experience.
It already is for some Gary residents, like Rodney Lewis, who is optimistic that Hard Rock will deliver in ways not seen here before.
It's a rebirth because you've got the branding of Hard Rock, and it adds an almost instant feeling of legitimacy when a company like Hard Rock comes here to bring in entertainment, and it's almost like a revitalization of the area.
Oh, I think it's going to be great.
Another Gary resident, Karen Williams, thinks the new casino will be a boon for local entertainers.
It expands the whole region's view of entertainment, bringing a little bit of Las Vegas showy stuff to the region.
And unlike the other casino properties nearby, Hard Rock has reached out to the community to attract local vendors, like Erica Buchanan, who runs a Gary-based skincare company. She hopes to sell some of her products in Hard Rock Casino's gift shops.
I think the opportunities could possibly be endless because they're Hard Rock International. So hopefully that we can get Gary residents in and they can see how hard we work, and they will want to take us to different places, maybe overseas somewhere one day.
I'm Michael Puente.
A new Grow Your Own Teacher initiative in the Bloomington Public School District aims to empower young people of color to picture themselves as future educators. Dana Vollmer reports.
So the class of 2029, Vincent King.
Oh, Vincent King!
Hallelujah! 9 students at Irving Elementary took part in their first graduation ceremony of many. They're the inaugural class of Project C, or Students Entering Education, a collaboration between District 87 and Illinois State University. The long-term goal is to address a lack of diversity in teaching, but short-term, organizers want to keep students on track to succeed in school. That's why the project gave the kids graduation trophies with their high school graduation date.
I'm gonna graduate in 10 years.
Tennille's in second grade. She says high school graduation feels like a long time from now, but she's already making some career plans.
I want to be a nurse to help old people.
and some backup plans.
If I don't want to be a nurse, I could get a job to be a teacher or work at a restaurant or wash people's cars to get money.
Brandon Thornton teaches math at Bloomington High School. He's a co-creator of Project C. Thornton says engaging with kids from an early age is important because they're already forming ideas about what it means to hold certain jobs.
A lot of the programs only focus on seniors, and so we decided to, why are we missing out on the third and fourth graders and fifth graders who might have career goals? And so now is the time to kind of swoop in and kind of empower them so they can see themselves as an educator.
Thornton says even elementary schoolers latch on to the idea that teachers are undervalued.
Some of it is rooted in truth, but our interactions with the kids, we want to make sure that it's positive so they can see, oh, these are teachers in our district. They're happy, they're smiling, they're living happy lives. And so a lot of it is us modeling that behavior.
Thornton says that also benefits the ISU student teachers helping with the program. He says Project C bridges a gap in understanding between students and educators.
We know that students of color are disproportionately disciplined in the classroom, which means there's less of them in the building, but they're the most people getting in-school suspensions, detentions, out-of-school suspensions, and so there's an issue there. And so the issue could be that the students are interacting with people who might understand their culture or background.
Project C co-founder Jen Brooks teaches language arts at Bloomington Junior High. She says just spending time with these kids reaffirms that teachers can and should look like them.
Because when you look at the classroom, like, this is what it looks like, right? It's not just one group of people. And how can you, like, conceptualize or see yourself as something if you've never had that model?
Brooks and Thornton had not met before the creation of Project C. Brooks says they instantly connected over their passion to bring diverse voices into the classroom.
Statistics show that historically, since the Brown versus Board of Education decision, the black teacher shortage never replenished itself, right? And so, like, yes, we have a national teacher shortage, but a more pressing issue as it relates to teachers of color.
Thornton says for now, conversations on race and barriers to entering education aren't as heavy as they'd like for them to be, given the students' ages. But he says this is just year one of Project C. The goal is to keep this same class engaged and work with them through high school graduation, bringing on younger generations along the way. Thornton says for now, students just want to know the basics.
They're asking questions about what's a salary? What do I have to do to be a doctor? What is college? And so those are questions that we were happy to help them with. And I think that little spark of curiosity could lead to many places.
Thornton says the highlight of the year was a visit to ISU's campus. 10-year-old Vincent had never been to ISU before, despite growing up just 10 minutes away.
It was really nice. We got to eat lunch for free, I think. And the teachers there were, like, say, like, I should work there one day because, like, I knew my way around and stuff.
Vincent says the trip got him excited about life after graduation.
To meet different people or people I never met.
Thornton says while this sounds simple, being able to visualize college life is a huge motivator.
I think for a lot of kids, they grow up hearing their families talk about college. Maybe they have siblings in college. That's not necessarily true for everyone. And so we wanted them to get on campus just so they could see themselves as a college student.
And no matter what profession the kids ultimately pursue, Thornton says he hopes Project C will give them the confidence to know they belong in those spaces. I'm Dina Vollmer.
You're listening to Statewide. After an all-time high during the pandemic, rates of food insecurity among American families are finally starting to decline. Nearly one in five families experienced hunger at the height of the pandemic. Diane Schanzenbach directs the Institute for Policy Research at Northwestern University, and she's been tracking these statistics. She says while the decline is good news, we're not out of the woods yet.
Some of the worst, I think, is behind us, but there's still going to be elevated need. I would expect, you know, for quite some time, probably years, even though, you know, we'll clearly be getting better, the economy will be healing, et cetera.
She says federal stimulus checks and increased funding for SNAP benefits have been especially helpful in decreasing food insecurity. Well, next, one of the more popular natural areas to visit in southern Illinois is the Crab Orchard National Wildlife Refuge. At nearly 44,000 acres, it covers parts of three counties. It includes Crab Orchard Lake. And reporter Kevin Boucher of WSIU tells us it draws people from near and far.
My name is Sam Copeland, and I live in Chicago.
And you're here at Crab Orchard, and tell me what you were saying earlier. How long have you been coming to this place?
Last spring, during the beginning of the pandemic, a partner of mine introduced me to it, and I fell in love.
That was at Prairie Creek Recreation Area, where busy Route 13 carries thousands of cars every day over the lake. And this bank fisherman says he visits a lot.
William Eastwood, and I'm from Marion.
How long have you been coming to this area? For some time?
Yeah, every day.
Really?
Yes, every day I come down here.
What's so good about this place?
Fish, okay. Crappie.
Eastwood says he also really enjoys seeing the Canada geese and their families.
There was a couple of them here yesterday. Had three babies, mama and daddy and the three babies. And, you know, they're fun watching them.
But we don't have the numbers of Canada geese that we used to. Here is Neil Vincent. He's the visitor services manager at Crab Orchard National Wildlife Refuge. And he says some ponds on the refuge and some parts of the lake itself don't have nearly the numbers of geese that they once did.
Things are changing here. When the refuge was established, we were a big wintering area for Canada geese. So these areas were shut down to like visitors activities, September the 30th, October the 1st, when the geese started arriving. Those geese don't come here anymore. So we've been looking at these areas and saying, actually we can extend these because they're not really interfering with any type of our wildlife management. And so it makes it still compatible with what we're doing here on the refuge.
Which brings up the question, how many Canada geese did we see here in southern Illinois? And when did they start declining? For those answers, I went to SIU's Campus Lake and asked avian ecologist Professor Mike Eichholz of the School of Biological Sciences at SIU Carbondale.
The peak years were definitely in the late 80s and early 90s. During that period, we saw about almost a million Canada geese between Horseshoe Lake, State Wildlife Area, and then the Crab Orchard National Wildlife Refuge. I think the peak year was 1989, maybe 1990. I can't remember for sure.
Okay. And right now, as we're talking in 2021, what are those numbers today?
I haven't looked recently, but I believe last year was a low year, and it was around 2,000.
And because of this drastic change in numbers, Neil Vincent with the refuge says they will be changing some of the land use plans.
We're trying to make more of our areas more accessible year-round for like fishing and more opportunities. For example, we have four different ponds that's in a restricted use area, and usually we close these ponds down around September the 30th to fishing for like waterfowl to come through. So we are proposing on three of those ponds to open those up year-round now. So if this passes October the 1st, those ponds will be open from sunrise to sunset year-round. And at this time also, we do not allow any type of flotation devices on those ponds. So starting October the 1st, if you got a kayak or canoe or one of these float tubes, you'll be able to use those. Basically, we're just saying no gasoline motors. Then parts of Crab Orchard Lake are closed, during that same time period, mostly the eastern part of the lake, and we're opening it for boat traffic and fishing for an extra 30 days each year. So we tacked on 15 days at the beginning and 15 days at the end of that section of Crab Orchard Lake. And that's just to give, anglers more opportunity to fish out here.
And Vincent adds, even though the numbers of Canada geese are way down, the refuge is still popular, despite the COVID-19 pandemic.
When it first hit, no one was working. Everyone was at home. They had started sitting in the house. April, June, and May of last year, we had four times more visitation than we usually have. And still the same thing. Our numbers are still up. We're seeing more people bank fishing. And it may have hurt some of the long driving tourism type activities. It looks like the locals have discovered us again.
That was Neil Vincent, Visitor Services Manager at Crab Orchard National Wildlife Refuge. And later we will hear from a waterfowl expert on why the refuge and southern Illinois do not have hundreds of thousands of Canada geese anymore. I'm Kevin Boucher.
We'll have more of that story just ahead. Statewide continues. Stay with us. We're back on Statewide, and now Kevin Boucher continues his report from Southern Illinois. He talked with Ken Shaw of Carbondale. He and his wife are frequent visitors to the Crab Orchard National Wildlife Refuge.
I come here every year. I've been doing as long as we've been camping. I come to Crab Orchard every year. About 2015, we got our first camper, and we come every year and enjoy it out here. Love the nature and the birds and all the things that you get to see that you don't in a lot of campgrounds. It's great to be able to come out and see pelicans and geese.
Will they come up here by your site?
Well, they will walk around in your backyard. They are just like pets. And a little later here, they'll start hatching out the little goslings, and you will see a half a dozen mature and 15 or 20 little goslings, and they'll be anywhere from 2 weeks to 3 weeks, and they're all different sizes.
Oh, they're cute.
But they aren't afraid of you here. They feel very secure. They will get in the road, and you'll have to stop and wait for them to get out of the road, because it's a refuge, and we live here, and we own it, so you have to wait until we're done walking in the road.
And while encounters like that are common at Crab Orchard Refuge, what is not common are the tens of thousands of Canada geese that used to come to the refuge every fall and winter, much to the delight of hunters and tourism officials. At the peak, what were the numbers of Canada geese like? Here is Professor Mike Eicholtz. He is an avian ecologist at SIU Carbondale.
The peak years were definitely in the late 80s and early 90s. During that period, we saw about almost a million Canada geese between Horseshoe Lake, Union County Wildlife, State Wildlife Area, and then the Crab Orchard National Wildlife Refuge.
Why do they winter here? Because it was way too cold up north and they couldn't feed on frozen lakes?
Well, I think one of the things we have to remember is the geese wintering in southern Illinois was relatively a recent phenomenon. Historically, the same geese that we used to see wintering in southern Illinois wintered down in Arkansas, Mississippi, and Alabama. Then we saw a fairly substantial change, a shift in their wintering locations in the 1940s and 1950s. We think that was probably due to primarily changes in agricultural practices. During that period, there was a lot of agricultural development after the Second World War in southern Illinois. That's when combines were developed. And that use of more modern agricultural equipment left a lot more waste grain in the fields for the geese during the winter. And so I think those things combined basically allowed the geese to not have to migrate quite as far south. So instead of going down to Arkansas and Mississippi, they started stopping in southern Illinois to spend the winter.
Now, fast forward to 2021, where we don't see nearly the numbers of Canada geese on Crab Orchard Refuge as we did 30 years ago. Is climate change the reason?
I don't think it's climate change. I think it's probably another change in agricultural practices. You know, we saw a really dramatic change in the, like I said, in the late 80s and early 90s. And during that time is when the National Resource Conservation Service, we often call them the Soil Conservation Service, they were interested in trying to reduce runoff in fields. So they were encouraging farmers to start what we called soil conservation practices. So those are practices where they, instead of till the fields in the fall, they wait and till them in the spring, or they use what we call no-till planting. So what we call no-till drills, where they don't have to till the fields at all. Well, when we stopped tilling during the fall, that provided a lot more waste grain that was still on the surface available for the geese. And so I think what happened was during that transition from the fall tillage to the spring tillage or no-till, provided a lot more grain in the waste grain in the fields farther north, and so they just didn't have to migrate anymore.
And it looks like the geese are going places to get away from hunters, like large cities. For example, Chicago is seeing a lot of Canada geese.
Absolutely. I've been collaborating with a group from the University of Illinois, and we've been studying the Canada geese in the Chicago area. They've adapted to the point where it looks like what they do now is acquire a lot of fat reserves early in the fall before the hunting season starts, then move into Chicago and spend the entire winter grazing on vegetation that's really nutritionally poor. They build up a lot of fat reserves before winter, then they can use those fat reserves to survive through the winter feeding on this really poor vegetation. So it's kind of this trade-off. They spend the winter feeding in an area where the food's not very good, but there's no hunters, so they're safe. There's probably now, we don't really have a good estimate, but probably, you know, at least 100,000, maybe more, that spend the winter in Chicago.
SIUC Professor Mike Eichholz on some of the reasons Canada geese don't visit southern Illinois in the hundreds of thousands like they used to. I'm Kevin Boucher.
It was 10 years ago that Brian Gaines did a survey to hear what people would like to see in political maps that are changed every decade following the U.S. Census. Gaines is a professor with the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs, and he repeated that survey recently and wrote an essay on it. He talked about the project with Maureen McKinney.
You conducted a national survey to find out what the public prefers when it comes to redistricting. Who would they like to see draw the maps?
I gave them a set of choices that included a nonpartisan commission, a computer program designed by someone who's outside of politics, a state government, the legislature and the governor, a bipartisan commission, or a judge randomly chosen from the Supreme Court. And I let them say, I don't know. Don't know was a fairly popular response, and that wasn't a surprise because redistricting is a pretty specialized kind of subject matter. But the most popular answer by far was a nonpartisan commission.
Several considerations go into the redistricting process. What criteria did the respondents to your survey say were most important to them?
The justification for redistricting is the districts ought to be very close to equal in population. So that's one criteria of what makes a good map. And I didn't ask the respondents to rank that one because it's pretty much accepted by everybody, but that's what redistricting means. You make equally sized districts. So I asked them about some other criteria. The district should take simple shapes. They should follow existing county and city lines. They should result in the parties getting about the same proportion of seats in the legislature as they have a vote share. They should make sure there's a proportionate number of African-American representatives to the population or Hispanic representatives to the Hispanic side of the population. And they should make competitive districts, one other, which is towns and neighborhoods that have a lot in common should be put in the same district as much as possible. There was really some support for all of those ideas, but the one that got the most support was the overall percentage of seats won by each major party should be about the same as its percentage of the total vote. Attention, they're suspicious of maps that can turn a 50-50 state into a 75-25 legislature where one party is getting a lot more bang for its buck.
You presented hypothetical legislative districts and asked respondents to pick the one they thought was best. Can you tell me a little about the districts they preferred?
Most complicated question I had, but to me it's the most interesting one. I gave the respondents a very stylized version of redistricting. They had a kind of a square hypothetical state that had like a checkerboard, what I was calling counties, square units that were either completely Republican or completely Democratic. And the state on the whole was a 50-50, exactly equally divided state. And there were six different ways to split up. And the thing that was striking to me was that even the respondents who said they were very partisan, they self-identified as strong Republicans or strong Democrats, did not like the maps that helped their party, the gerrymanders. The fairest in that respect also had twisty, unusual shapes. And I think respondents are suspicious of those, even if they can't really put their finger on what's wrong with them or who's cheating and how. They don't like maps that have districts that are not very compact, that aren't relatively square and following obvious boundaries.
What have the courts said about what is and isn't allowed in electoral maps?
The U.S. Supreme Court fairly recently said partisan gerrymandering is not something the courts can prevent, for a variety of reasons, including that political science hasn't done a good enough job of giving them the tools to reliably identify partisan gerrymanders. But in essence, they've said the party that controls the redistricting process, that chooses to draw a map, that harvests votes into seats much more easily for one party than the other, can get away with it. That's not illegal. On the other hand, there's still a lot of pretty complicated jurisprudence, but very strong requirements for racial representation, that a map that's found to be minimizing representation of African-Americans or Spanish-speaking Americans, Hispanics and Latinos, or in some context, Asian-Americans, is much more likely to be, at least in federal courts, thrown out as illegal because it's diluting voting power of protected groups. The other thing I think, and it's going to matter a lot, is the courts have been pretty insistent on districts being almost exactly equal in population. The maps that Illinois now has, is they're not finalized, of course, but the legislature just released on Friday, like any map that's been drawn at this stage, is not using the official census data. So it strikes me as very likely that there will be litigation about the legality of using these estimates. The Illinois Constitution doesn't require the use of census data, but ultimately those are the data that tell us how many people live in a district. And courts have been pretty strict about not letting map makers, whoever they are, draw districts that vary in size so that people in one district effectively lower voting power than those in another district.
Brian Gaines is a professor with the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs. You can read his essay on redistricting at our website. We have a link at statewideshow.com. Some of the members of the new U.S. Space Force are stationed at Scott Air Force Base in Belleville. About 2 months ago, these 19 U.S. Air Force airmen became Space Force Guardians. They'll stay at Scott for now until they transfer to an official Space Force command in the next year or so. Eric Schmid reports on what has and has not changed for members of America's latest military branch.
Specialist Michaela Sossville was feeling particularly anxious the day she learned if she'd be transitioning to the U.S. Space Force.
Just nervous knots in my stomach, walking up to anybody who might have any information, asking them, do you know if I made it? I just want to know ahead of time if I didn't make it.
Sossville was one of two from the four applicants in her office who were picked to be Space Force Guardians back in December.
And so it was really hard having to be excited about something that my fellow airmen weren't getting accepted into.
In the months since the announcement, Sossville says she's remained close with her colleagues, and they now even joke about her leaving the Air Force. That won't happen for another year or year and a half when she and the other 18 Guardians transfer to an official Space Force command in California, Colorado, or Florida. For now, the day-to-day assignments for the Guardians still at Scott Air Force Base haven't changed. Specialist Jaime Alvarado is a client systems technician, ensuring communications for the Air Force stay up.
So there's a military motto called hurry up and wait. That seems like it goes through all the branches and now even to the Space Force. It's literally a lot of waiting. But it creates that excitement too. Like I said, you don't know what's going to come next.
Really, the only noticeable difference for the new Guardians is on their uniforms, which now say Space Force instead of Air Force. But that small change is significant. Tech Sergeant Ryan Berry says it's reshaped how he handles his work now.
I'm not taking it for granted anymore. I'm more like trying to get into the weeds of it to better understand it since I'm also a retrainee.
Berry spent his first 7 years in the Air Force in a unit that handles on-base facilities before training into the 375th Communications Squadron, where he now works on cybersecurity.
I have a different type of energy now because I know I'm about to move over and do something not greater, if anything, but just something on a different scale.
He says the Space Force pushes the bounds of where the military operates. It's this different and expanded mission that gets Alvarado and many of the other new Guardians excited for what they're going to work on.
My dream would be some type of work on a spaceship, if I could contribute of sending a spaceship into orbit, or even a satellite into orbit, honestly.
Alvarado also highlights the historical significance of joining a new military service, the first one since the Air Force formed in 1947. Lieutenant Colonel Ryan Schiffner commands the 375th Communications Squadron at Scott. He says the new Space Force Guardians have a rare opportunity.
They're being trusted to stand up a new service, something that our nation has not seen in over 70 years.
And with that comes the chance to influence how the Space Force takes shape.
That I will obey the orders of the President.
Sossville helped plan February's induction ceremony at Scott and says she helped make it a little bit different than ones at other bases.
We did our formation in the Delta symbol. So that's our own little pizzazz on the Space Force.
She explained it's the same symbol that will be on the insignia that represents someone's rank in the Space Force. Sossville says she's proud to have leadership that seeks her input and voice.
Didn't think they would actually want our input on what we are going to be as a Space Force, as a lower enlisted member.
Barry says he feels like he can take greater ownership of the new command.
I'm able to basically build something that maybe my daughter can get into one day.
Lieutenant Colonel Schiffner says it makes sense Space Force leadership is listening to its newest members. He says the country doesn't have a blueprint for how to set up that kind of military command.
You want to bring in individuals who have a voice, who have powerful insights, great ideas, and innovative concepts. I mean, that's going to be part of the core of what the Space Force is about.
Schiffner adds Space Force is getting some of Scott's best airmen. The new Guardians get to lay the groundwork for a branch of the military that they hope will last for hundreds of years. At Scott Air Force Base, I'm Eric Schmid.
That's all the time we have for Statewide this week. We'll be back next time with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this week's show, you can go to our website. All of our episodes are available at statewideshow.com. You can also drop us a line. Let us know what you think. Also, our weekly podcast can be heard through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.